Mr. Condren, reel three.
Well, as I say, there were a few cases where people were accidentally killed. But on the whole, on the raids I was involved in personally, we didn't meet any real opposition. I suppose one of the reasons for it, they probably had fairly good intelligence, and they knew where they were going, that it was probably undefended and so on. I don't know exactly about that, but one would presume that was the case. So we continued doing that for a short time. When was it? Up to about November, I think, 1950.
When did you start them?
You know, I can't really remember exactly what time I went. When we went, once the war broke out, we must have gone there about end of July or August, I suppose, about the Japan. And it was about 3 months.
About how many raids would you have done in that time?
Commando as a whole, I think we did about six, thereabouts.
And were you on them all?
I wasn't on them all, I was on about half that number.
Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy them or not?
I did quite enjoy them, yes. It was quite an adventure, and it was what we'd been trained to do, and yes, I suppose on the whole I enjoyed it. I might have enjoyed it less had the intelligence been less efficient and we met real opposition.
Did you take any Koreans with you?
No. As far as I recall, there were no Koreans with us.
Did you?
There may have been, but as far as I remember, there weren't. No. We were only British. There was one American in the group I was with. There was one American, I think he was a naval lieutenant. But he was part of their, I don't know, American Rangers, I think, do mostly the jobs that commandos are trained to do. And he was the only one that ever came in on raids with us, and he was given an honorary green beret, which he used to wear. But aside from him, as far as I remember, there were no Koreans involved, nor North Americans involved, on the actual raiding parties.
Would you come across civilians on these raids?
We did occasionally, yes.
What happened to them?
Well, as far as I know, none of them were shot. We had a sort of... Well, of course, we couldn't take prisoners. You go in six or eight men in a boat, you come out six or eight men in a boat. Unless one is specifically charged with taking prisoners for intelligence reasons. But the idea was that if we came across opposition, military or civilian, that we shot to kill. I mean, this was the idea. But in actual fact, one raid I was on, we came across, there was a group of civilians, a couple of elderly men and women, and I think maybe two or three smaller children, 14, 15, something like that. And they just got caught between, us getting back and getting to the beach. And what we did is we just tied them up in such a way that they could free themselves within an hour or so and left them near the edge of the beach, and we just went off. We gagged them and tied them up. But as I say, in a way that they could free themselves within an hour or so, we'd be well away by then.
Was anybody killed on the raids that you... the three raids that you went on yourself?
What, you mean by enemy action?
No, either civilians or enemy personnel.
Or Koreans, you mean?
Yes.
Not as far as I recall. I mean, in the case of... where I just explained to you that we were fired upon, well, we were already out in the boats, and I presume that they were... mostly killed because they came under some rather heavy fire from the ship. But nothing I ever saw. Yeah.
Did you ever bring any prisoners back?
No.
Yeah. It sounds as though the three raids you were on had a high degree of success.
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. But whether or not this was a matter of luck or sound judgment, I hesitate to say, because I don't know. I wasn't privy to what, you know, intelligence work went on before. But one would imagine that it was fairly sound.
What happened next in November once you'd finished those raids?
Well, we'd go on the raid and then we'd go back usually to the camp, you know, for a week or two, depending. The time there was just spent in training. The whole time we were just training, either up on the range or in boats and so on. The commander was then instructed to go to Korea, to the mainland. By this time, of course, the American and South Korean forces had pushed up quite away towards the north. And reading the papers and looking at the maps and so on, you know, one presumed that the war would very quickly come to an end because the, you know, North Korea would be conquered. We were then instructed that the commander was to go to the mainland and actually to join up with the American 1st Marine Division, which we did. We went over on a ship and eventually joined up with this was our whole commando. We joined up with the 1st Marine Division. I have heard it said since, I don't know, I could never actually determine whether or not it was true, but I have heard it said. You see, at that time they weren't quite sure if the Chinese had come into the war, and if they had, they weren't quite sure in what numbers they had come into the war. There were various rumors at the time. And I was given to understand that the reason we were sent there was that we were supposed to be to get in behind the lines, either as a whole commander or as in small groups. And we would carry light weapons, and we would be supplied by airdrop. The idea being, as I say, I'm not absolutely sure of this. This is, in some ways, what we used to call Marine scuttlebutt or rumor. I'm not absolutely sure of it. It would make sense to me that we were to operate in small groups in the hills and in the mountains and try to make some sort of intelligent estimate as to what numbers, well, first of all, if the Chinese were there, and try to estimate in what sort of numbers they were there. In other words, it was an intelligence gathering operation, which we were supposed to have done. Unfortunately, we were in a convoy which was on the way up to the Chosun Reservoir. We were in a convoy of trucks.
To which reservoir?
To the Chosun Reservoir. This is up near Wonsan, Hungnam. It's up on the northeast coast of Korea. There's a very large reservoir there called the Chosun Reservoir. And we were, as I say, attached to the 1st Marine Division. There was also an element of the American 7th, I think it was the 7th Regiment, the cavalry. I can't remember how many trucks we were in, 30, 40, 50, something like that. But we moved up towards the reservoir. There was quite a considerable amount of snow around at the time. It was pretty cold, November, of course. And, the convoy was attacked. We were moving up a sort of valley with hills on both sides. And moving along a very narrow road. It couldn't have been more than 10 or 12 feet wide, this road. And at first we came under sort of intermittent fire, and as we progressed it got heavier. We had a few tanks up in the front, and most of the infantry was at the front. I was with the headquarters group of our commander, and we were actually on one of the trucks moving up. We set off early one morning, and came under fire, intermittent fire at first, and it gradually became heavier. I think what happened was as our tanks and the main body of the troops went up, the Koreans and or Chinese, I don't exactly know, well, it was Chinese actually, but they were a sort of mixture. I think they kind of disappeared over the hills, but they were dug in on the hills. And when the tanks moved up ahead, they simply just came back to their previous dug-in positions on the hillsides. And we were kind of sitting targets on the road, and if you can imagine the road in the middle of the valley, and there on both sides. Anyway, they finally, they mortared one of the trucks up ahead, and they mortared one or two trucks at the back, effectively blocking the road at both ends. And then they just gradually closed in. And quite a considerable number of our people got through at the end. It was the last, I don't know, 20 trucks or something like that that were actually caught. And
what kind of cover could you take, personally?
Not very much when we were on the trucks. And at first we just stayed on the trucks. And there were a few bullets whizzing around. And I presume there was a number of people hit. When the trucks finally ground to a halt, we were ordered off the trucks. And at both sides of this little road we were on, there was a small kind of monsoon ditch on running up from both sides. So we just got into this little ditch or trench on either side. You couldn't always see the enemy on the hillside. You occasionally saw them ducking from foxhole to foxhole, but there weren't sort of masses of them. It was a very confused and chaotic situation, in actual fact.
Did you fire any rounds yourself?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. How much?
God knows. I'd probably lost count. We had plenty of ammunition. It was no problem.
So how long were you in action for, approximately?
That particular battle lasted 17 hours. And, during it, as I say, it was, I don't know, late morning, I suppose, when it started. It went on until it got dark. And must have been about, 2 or 3 in the morning or something. We had one lieutenant with us. We only had one officer, one Royal Marine officer there. I think he was a Lieutenant Evans at the time. And we were pretty well stuck and surrounded. There was nothing much we could do. I tried several radios to try and get in touch with someone, ask for tanks or help of some sort. But we couldn't raise anyone at all. And eventually Evans came around and we came to the Royal Marines, to the commandos, and he asked for volunteers to try and break up, to get back to the CP, or American Command Post. I didn't have much hesitation in volunteering, because as I saw it, it was a fire and frying pan situation. I thought I might as well have a crack at getting up. And so I volunteered to go. I think there was about 12 of us in all, with the officer. And so we sort of, I was going to say formed up in single file. We didn't form up. We were in a ditch, and we actually sort of crawled and half ran and so on along the ditch. And finally we made our way down to the eastern end of the road, if you like. And we then came to a rather open area which we had to cross, a sort of large field, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred yards across. And if you can imagine the situation at the time, it was very cold, there was flurries of snow. There was snow everywhere, sometimes 2, 3 feet, 6 foot deep, well, it just depended where you were. There were trucks blazing, there was mortars coming in on us. There were flares going up, and as far as I recall, it was also a bit of a moon out, and it was quite, at times it was almost daylight, but in many ways, totally chaotic.
Many casualties?
Yes, quite a number. There's quite a number of casualties. And anyway, we finally got down to this, as I say, this area, this field that we had to get over. And we had a quick little confab, and we decided we'd go over in one at a time, with maybe 10 seconds in between, you see. And I don't know, the first six or eight people, they got over all right. We saw them, we got to the other side. And then I was among the last three of us. And when it came our turn to get over this field, I think the Chinese, Koreans, they must have spotted people going over. And we got about a quarter way across between us, maybe 10, 12 seconds, but eventually we got huddled together because we came under so much fire. There was just, there was everything coming at us. There was mortars coming down, there were traces. It just seemed to me like I was in a bee's nest, you know, the bullets were zooming out. It didn't hit any of us, fortunately. We just get to our feet and we'd make a mad dash for, you know, 5 or 6 feet and then throw ourselves flat. And we just continued doing this until we got to the other side. But it must have taken us so a good hour to get across, because it meant you were just moving a few feet at a time and not always going in a straight line. Fortunately, none of us were hit. But by the time we got to the other side, there was no sign of the chaps that had gone before us. They must have looked back and saw that we were under heavy fire and presumed that we either weren't going to make it or we'd been hit. And they had left. They had gone. I later heard that most of them actually did get up. And Lieutenant Ovens certainly got up. I know that for a fact.
Was his name Evans or Ovens?
Ovens, O-V-E-N-S, I think it was. He was at that time a lieutenant. And we then, the three of us then, we didn't quite know we didn't quite know what to do. Well, we didn't quite know what to do in this situation, but we finally decided that we would plod on and try and catch up with the others if we possibly could. And at the other side of this open stretch of ground, we found ourselves in a stream, which was a very fast flowing stream, not very wide, maybe 10 feet wide, something like that. But very strong current. It was very, very cold, and it hadn't completely frozen over. There was a bit of ice at the edges, and we set off in sort of single file up, moving along this stream. And the chap at the front, who was an NCO, he was at the front. There was another chap in the middle, and I was bringing up the rear. And we moved off down the stream, and then he had to move out around this tree, which was sort of growing out of the side of the bank. And he was moving around it when suddenly there was a shot and he fell. He was actually killed outright. I think the bullet hit him in the neck and went out his head. And so we grabbed him quickly and pulled him back, and again not knowing exactly what was going on. And after a couple of minutes I heard voices from the other side, and it was American voices. And unfortunately, that's what had happened. There were some Americans who they were dug in on the other side of the tree in the bank, and they had just seen this shape coming around the tree. And the Americans, understandably, anything that wasn't wearing an American helmet, they shot at. And he only had his beret on. And they suddenly saw the shape, you know, coming out of the darkness and the half-light, and they just shot. So one can't really blame them for that. But I was a bit upset because he was a friend of mine. And then after a few minutes, I established contact with the Americans, and I shouted out and tried to explain to them who we were. And I was a bit cross, and I swore and said that they'd shot my mate. And so then they called out for me to come round, and I had an American steel helmet, that I'd taken from a dead American. I thought, well, you know, as the action progressed and things got hotter and hotter, I had less and less reliance on my green beret as a protective covering. And I took, I didn't take, you probably know the American steel helmet consists of an outer part, which they call the steel, and an inner part, which is made of fiberboard, which just fits, the steel fits over it. I had found a steel, but without the inside part lying around, and I just got it and slammed it over my beret and everything as protection. So I very warily came out around the bush shouting out to these Americans, don't fire now, I'm coming around. Anyway, I finally got there, and it was an American captain, and I think two sergeants were there, so I chatted with them, and we finally got this my mate's body around, and but he was dead, so I took his identity tags and his paybook and thing. And I asked the American captain if he had seen anything of our lads, you know, that had tried to get through, and he said he hadn't seen any of them. And I then asked him, I said, well, you know, what do you suggest we do? He said, well, he said, by this time there had been a bit of lull in the firing, and things seemed to have quietened down a bit. And he said, well, the best thing, he said, is just, they had quite a number of troops sort of dug in around in the area. No sort of fixed lines or anything, but a number of them. And he said, well, probably your best bet is just to stay here with us. He said, it's a few more hours, it's going to be light. And they'll send trucks up for us and we'll take us back to the CP, you see. So I thought, well, that's probably as good as anything. There was no point. Two of us trying to break out, and we didn't know, you know, which direction to take. So we stayed there with them. We got another foxhole, and we stayed there. Of course, I was soaked because we'd been up to sort of almost up to our waist in water. And as I say, it was pretty cold. It wasn't at that time, but in Korea, it can get sort of 45 plus below zero. It can get pretty damn cold. And of course, my trousers and everything froze. And we had these American shoe packs on, which is a kind of leather bottom with a rubber that's sort of almost coming up to the knee, lace up. So I took my boots and I took a pair of socks on, so I took them off and hung them on a little branch of a tree. They very quickly froze solid. And I rubbed my feet to get the circulation back. Fortunately, I had a spare pair of socks in one of my pockets. I put those on, and I wrapped my camouflage scarf around one foot, and I put my green beret around the other foot and squeezed back into these boots, and just kept my toes moving. So it was all right. And then it gradually got light as dawn broke, and people started moving around, and they were lighting fires here and there, and all the firing had stopped by this time. So we presumed, you see, don't forget that we were slightly removed from the main body, slightly. And we didn't know what was happening, but presumed that the battle was over, and we were just waiting for trucks to come up and take us back. So everyone was sort of wandering around. There was fires burning, made fires with crates and so on. People having a smoke, and then I came across one of our marine drivers who had been hit in the hip, and he was a bit shaky. So I dragged him over by a fire and put him, you know, gave him a cigarette, got him warmed up a bit, and he'd been hit in the hip, just a flesh wound. So I whipped him over and I cut away the trousers, and I put some powder on, some sulfanamide, and was bandaging him up.
Put what on?
Sort of powder. It's a wound powder that we have. I think it was sulfanamide. I think it was called something like that. Some sort of sulfur thing. Just packets of stuff. But he wasn't too bad. He was all right. And so I was kneeling down, bandaging him up. And as I say, in all of our minds, we were just waiting for the trucks to come up, and I had an M1 rifle on my shoulder. I'd had a carbine originally, but I'd flung it away because it was so cold that when you fired it, the block just froze and it wouldn't fire. It's too light. but the M1 was better. And another thing, when as I'd say, Adams, when he came round for volunteers, because by that time our ammunition was running short, and we had a quick collection from people in the immediate area, so we got, each one of us had about 15 rounds and one or two grenades that we, you know, we collected before we tried to make this break up. So I'm kneeling down on one knee attending to him, and then suddenly I heard behind me this this grunt. And I'm like, "Oh, yes," you see. I looked around and I saw what I thought was a South Korean, and because he was wearing a snow cape. The South Koreans used to wear white snow capes, you see. And I turned around and looked at him, and you see, in my mind, I'm waiting for the trucks to come out. And this chap standing there, and he's pointing a Thompson at me, you see. And so I just ignored him. And then, you know, a couple of seconds later, again, there's another, "Oh!" Yeah. So I looked around, and then I thought, "God, it must be some South Korean who's been shell-shocked." You see. And then, again, there was a, "Oh!" you see, and he leveled this Thompson at me, and I sort of stood up. I was just about to have a go at him, when suddenly one of the Americans nearby, he shouted, I'll never forget, he shouted, "Hey, buddy," he said, "you better throw that rifle down. We've surrendered." Well, no one had told me. And I took this rifle down, and I flung it down like I said, "Nobody tells us bugger all around here," or words to that effect. And the next thing I know is this little fellow with a Thompson behind me, he comes running over and starts shaking me by the hand. And he was Chinese. But he must have got the snow cape from some dead South Korean. And that's how I became a prisoner of war.
Seems strange that he should shake you by the hand.
Very strange. Very strange. He probably misunderstood my action in throwing the rifle down. I don't know what was in his mind. I just don't know. But I flung the rifle down because I was so peeved and pissed off, because I could have been shot, because nobody had told me we'd surrendered. And that's, you know, that's what made me angry. And I don't know, he probably misconstrued my action, but anyway, the net result was that he came running over and he grabbed me by the hand and started shaking my hand.
What happened next?
I didn't know what to make of it. Well, we sort of didn't know what was going to happen then. You know, that we'd surrendered, and it was, well, at that time we didn't think about it too much, because we thought as commandos we'd probably be shot. Because in the Second World War, when the Germans caught commandos, they shot them as spies. And we didn't know if we were going to get the same sort of treatment or what, but I didn't think too seriously by the time. Is it mentally, it was a sort of total mix-up. Anyway, we stood around these fires. There was a few Chinese troops around here and there, and they came up and they took weapons away from people. Rifles, pistols, grenades they took. You know, it wasn't a very thorough search. It was just basic, you know, things that they could see. And some short time after that, it must have been about 10 or 15 minutes after that, that this chap appeared, and he was an officer, a Chinese officer, a small chap, who spoke English. So I can't remember exactly this group that I was with, but there must, I don't know, 20 or 30 people, and sort of gathered us all together, and then he gave us a little speech.